This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
First of all, let me welcome all of you here tonight. I want to thank you for coming to the conversation between Jean-Michel Rabaté and Greg Lambert. This conversation will ultimately be published as part of a special issue of the Journal of Cultural and Religious Theory this spring, which is devoted to the future of theory. And it will include other interviews with Dorothea Olkowski and Alvital Ronell, as well as a number of essays on the subject, the future of theory. The participants tonight are, I think, uniquely qualified to speak about this subject. Jean-Michel's most recent book, The Future of Theory, constitutes one of the most succinct and far-reaching explorations of what has come to be known, both famously and now infamously, as theory. Likewise, Greg Lambert's work, which includes an analysis of the structure of the Academy, as well as a new book on Deleuze, has staked out the past and possible future of theoretical labor. Having said as much, what remains most exciting and symbolic about tonight's event is its very form. The institutional history of theory in Anglo-American academic circles has traditionally rendered theory in the shape of lectures, manifestos, polemics, and explications, all of which suggest the looming presence of a master discourse. By contrast, tonight's event represents a conversation, and perhaps this may serve as a model for a different kind of theoretical endeavor. Indeed, we might recall as a precedent the collaborative nature of the Frankfurt School, where critical theory constitutes a complex assemblage, a process of working and thinking together that does not simply take place, but that emerges as a pragmatics in order to formulate and address new problems. In this context, one last thing might be said about the prospect of tonight's event and indeed the creation of this theoretical assemblage. Collaboration requires patience, even generosity, and the history of theory in this country has sorely lacked these qualities. If we take the purloined letter conference at Johns Hopkins as the seminal introduction of theory to a U.S. audience, this is not only because it involved the two great Jacques, Lacan and Derrida, but because around these figures would ultimately congregate cliques, camps, groups, devotees, and even various assassins. By contrast, I've known the two participants tonight for the better part of 6 years, and in the process of working with them and learning from them, I've come to understand that their theoretical ethos, that which makes them such wonderful thinkers, that which makes them potential collaborators, is their commitment to what might be called tolerance, care, and hospitality. And so with that, I'm going to give you Jean-Michel Rabaté and Greg Lambert. One more thing needs to be said. Because this is being recorded, I ask that questions all wait for the end of the talk. Okay? Thanks.
Well, to begin, as Greg Flaxman aptly put it, this is a new forum for us, somewhat of a new genre. We're not interested in speaking to one another. Usually, theory is about not being interested in hearing or listening. At least this has become to be one of the representations. Jean-Michel's book, The Future of Theory, I think is very timely, not only for its historical scope, but because it represents a patient listening to the ground of what's been happening over the last 20 or 30 years. And so the idea of doing this conversation or interview of sorts was that to begin a new discourse that was historical in perspective, but also extremely conversational because we have these living archives, these living memories, and none of the memories, in a sense, have a representation. And so in some ways this new form is a way for us to begin to record and to patiently and painstakingly retrace the ground that we've come so quickly over the last 20 or 30 years. So this conversation also spans two generations, Jean-Michel's generation and mine, as will become part of the conversation tonight. So I want to kind of move right into to Jean-Michel's book. In the book, there's a very dominant thesis that that theory is hysterical and that its discourse is a hysterical discourse. And I recall a line from Difference and Repetition, which forecasts a style of philosophy for the future regarding what Deleuze called a bearded Mona Lisa and a clean-shaven Marx. This line returned to me as I read, Jean-Michel, your account of the future of theory with regard to your description of what you call a hysterical Hegel. Now, I always thought Marx to be the hysterical one in the relationship with Hegel, but here you seem to be saying something different. Can you talk a bit about your use of the term hysterical with regard to the discourse of theory?
Yeah, thank you, Greg. This is a great question, and I'd like first to thank you all for being here and in this interestingly allegorical divided two eyes, so one to the left, one to the right. We don't really know who to look in the eyes, and I feel a little like when I'm at the barber shop and I'm talking with the man who's cutting my hair through, you know, I have to look at him in the mirror. So here we have this mirror, that's the camera. And maybe this is a hystericizing device, all yes. This, and belongs to what I was trying to describe in the book as the Hegelian hysterization of theory. I loved your, I have to say, I had a look at the questions earlier, but I didn't really read through them because I wanted this to be spontaneous. But I love this first question in the Mona Lisa, the bearded Mona Lisa and a clean-shaven Marx. First, because having read Wien's biography of Marx, I don't know whether you know this wonderful book, I used that in my recent Joyce book because the last photograph of Marx was taken in 1882 while he was in Algiers. And that time, for me, that was interesting. Joyce had just been born. And it took, so the last photograph is a bearded Marx, but then since he was under the sun of Algeria, he decided to shave his beard and get a very short haircut. But that was never photographed. So this is the last Marx that I would like to keep in mind, a shaven Marx. We have already, and I use that as well, a shaven Freud. There's a painting of Freud shaven, but a shaven Marx. And of course the bearded Mona Lisa calls up Duchamp. And for me, as you may know, and this is also somebody who has inspired a lot of my, say, animus-facing theory, the way Duchamp, as I think an artist but also a theoretician of art, could work with Mona Lisa to such a point that after he had done this Mona Lisa with a mustache and a beard and a goatee, that he signed El Hachoku, I won't translate it, he then had the same Mona Lisa without a beard, the usual Mona Lisa, but he called it Mona Lisa shaved. So this has to do, I think, with hysteria, and the question of hysteria for Lacan is fundamentally, am I a man or a woman? It's not exactly what I think is the key for theory, but after all, this is one of the questions that theory should start asking of us, not just because I'm interested in gender theory, but I think, and this is how I start criticizing Judith Butler, who is, I think, emblematic today of a certain discourse of gender theory, trying to go a little elsewhere, not necessarily further or backward, but elsewhere. And my idea of the hysterization that theory should entail was based on Lacan. I can say simply my starting point is Lacanian, although this book is not particularly Lacanian throughout, but I was always interested in the theory of the four discourses in Lacan and trying to see why theory as it had been in a way famously or infamously displayed, produced, staged in America, had to face this discourse of the university and was nevertheless never reducible to the discourse of the university. And so a famous anti-theoretician was Camille Paglia. And I have to say that a lot of this book, it may not be obvious to you, I don't know, is autobiographical. When I came to Penn 10 years ago, in 92, the first person I heard of, and I'd never heard her name, was Camille Paglia. And somebody, I won't mention her name, said I should invite her, I should invite Camille Paglia, because she had kicked Derrida in the ass. And I thought, that may be interesting, who is that? and then I heard Camille Paglia a few times, and indeed it was a hysterical reaction to a hystericizing discourse. So she was a living proof that, and she's still active, I suppose, in Philadelphia, that theory could antagonize, could hystericize, could produce effects that, for better or worse, are similar to hysteria. And so in that sense, I went back to the discourse of the surrealists, mostly, who in 1928 published this praise of hysteria. And what I did, it's one of the gestures in the opening of the book, was to take this manifesto for hysteria, written by Breton and his friends, and simply, whenever there was the word hysteria, I put the word theory. And it works. So that's...
Yeah, I think I remember Paglia at that time published an article in which she recommended that we have a second Boston Tea Party, and that we throw all the French into the sea.
Yes, so this is the autobiographical element, maybe.
Yeah.
I felt, you know.
You would be one of the French thrown into the sea. That's what you're reacting to.
Yeah. And I like this idea of this importation, you know. A lot has been written about the French as these interlopers, the you know, like the Greeks were for the Romans somehow, these sophists who would come. This is what Camille Paglia says, basically. Sophists who are invited to American universities because they make more money in the States, but they pervert everything, and they have indeed to be sanitized and thrown back and so on.
Well, even Derrida had a funny relationship, because I remember at the lecture at Cornell on the university and eyes of its pupils, he made constant reference to himself as the Professor Olage, which is a nautical term, also meaning from the high seas, somebody who's just landed. So,
right.
In a sense, he constantly talked about his position in the United States as being somebody who's just come off the boat, so to speak.
Right. I mean, this is indeed, if I may say something about this. Before I came to this country, I had worked with Derrida as a student at the Economie Supérieure, and it was interesting to compare how, let's say, in France, maybe this has changed a little now, he was not such a big star, but he was rumored to be very big in America, you know, like big in Japan. And and we were, oh, really, is he? And he was just, you know, somebody you would see like that, we could have a coffee with, and we'd say, oh, yeah, these Americans, they exhaust me, and so on. But it was like this mythical world of a good theoretician has to make it big in America.
Well, as you can see, my questions are going to be a bit, if we have time, because it depends on how much we like to talk, but if we have time, my questions will be kind of divided in three tenses: the present first, then I want to talk a little bit about the recent past, but then closing on the future. We may not have time to get to the future tonight. In the introduction to the book, you give a note or caution, as it may be, concerning what you describe as a burgeoning new consensus. And maybe a later stage or a second stage of this hysterization of theory. And that is, as you quote, as I quote you, a spreading reluctance to do or let do theory in the university. And I've also been witness to various disparate signs of this new consensus, the most evident of which for me was the gradual acceptance of a certain kind of historical narrative of theory itself, in which theory as capitalized or high theory, like in high modernism or high Baroque, has been supplanted for reasons of history, agenda, politics, constituency, by a kind of acephalic or decapitalized number of theoretical modes of inquiry under the headings of theories of gender, sexual identity, race, etc. There were two aspects to this myth that I witnessed when it began to become institutionalized at the level of departments and disciplines more recently, especially through professional organizations like the MLA. The first was the explicit charge of elitism against the dominant historical mode of theory such as deconstruction, psychoanalysis, and new historicism. Although I have to say with new historicism, I remember a line from an essay in which one of the new historicists talk about coming back from Thailand in first class and hearing the tinkling of ice in his scotch glass. But anyway, that could raise some charges of elitism. The second be described as an anti-systematic impulse, which again might be understood to actually refer to a certain style of Hegelianism that's now being reacted against. How do you understand these traits of elitism and system building to have become attached to the representation of theory in the U.S.?
Right. I think it's an important question. I think it's based on the misconception of theory, and I personally do not think that theory per se is elitist, but it poses the question of knowledge and a certain relationship to knowledge. I think one of the reasons why it was perceived as elitist when it emerged, say, in the 70s in the United States was that suddenly it opened a new library. Mm-hmm. That is, that suddenly literary scholars were more or less forced, willy-nilly, quickly, to read through Husserl, Heidegger, Habermas, all these French and German philosophers. And that was part of the seduction, but it was also what somehow precipitated a downfall. And in that sense, it has been relayed by new schools or new voices, and this is why I was quoting Judith Butler, because for me, clearly, and I have to say, I admire Judith Butler, although I disagree with certain things she says, I was surprised to see how adamant she was when she would say, no, I'm not doing theory, I'm doing activism, I'm doing politics, and theory is dead, and so on. Well, to me, this was a semantic problem. Mm-hmm. I think what she does is theory, and her background is in Hegel, and psychoanalytic discourse, and gender discourse, and so on. So I thought, how can she, somehow following Camille Paglia, who I think can be dismissed relatively quickly, how can she follow in the same gesture of saying, no, this is behind me, this is past, this is this elitist discourse, and of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and now we have to be in political, and so on. And in that sense, the difference is, I think, indeed, that we are talking about elite institutions somehow. Mm-hmm. And all the problems associated with tenure or not tenure in elite institutions. And in that sense, I can accept that it is elitist, but it's purely sociological. But otherwise, I don't think that fundamentally theory, except for the fact that it requires that you are conversant with a number of difficult texts, but I don't think that reading Plato is more difficult than, say, reading Hopkins or Shakespeare. But it opens to another dimension of the library, and it opens not only to that, but I think to another dimension of your own discourse. And I think this is also where things get complicated, since I believe that fundamentally, it's not my definition of theory, but it's one aspect of theory, is that you are supposed to account for what you do. And for instance, to be very concrete, it's something I often, and it's a little trick I play on my undergrads, which is simply to let them totally free in the choice of a topic, but to ask them to account for the reasons for which they have decided to treat this topic. It looks very simple like that, but as we know, it's not so easy to justify the choice of, let's say, discussing a poster or a film and so on, if you want this choice to be relevant and to have a connection with why they are students, why they want to do this and so on. Mm-hmm. I think this is this added level of discursive responsibility somehow that theory brings, and somehow it looks as if what was called elitist in the name of politics in the 90s, which is really the time when I came to Penn and to this country. I had already come to the States, but I hadn't seen the institutional struggles so clearly, because clearly, to me, what was simple was that all this problem is American. It doesn't exist in France, for the simple reason that we don't do theory. It may seem paradoxical, as many of the thinkers we mentioned have been in contact with French writers, but theory has not even a name, not even an institutional place in France. You can be a philosopher, you can be a sociologist, you can be an anglicist who has philosophical leanings, but it's only now that a certain number of terms have been imported back in France. England would be different, of course, but in France particularly, theory is just la théorie littéraire, so really literary theory, not the American meaning in which you have a lot of philosophy and lots of other things.
But talking or following up on the notion of the politicization or the current split between politics and or a kind of political position and the historization of a purely theoretical position that was so-called without politics, that kind of creates. Current anti-theory positions have charged theory with, quote, missing the real, and are implicitly described in your argument as stemming from an hysterical discourse. And the substitution of politics for theory, for example, in the case of Butler, who you cite, there is an implicit assertion that theory becomes more real or is suddenly restored to the real, which now has the status of, surprisingly, a missing object, the moment when theory takes on an overtly political subject or sense of agency. Hence, you write, quote, the post-romantic yearning of an unattainable other construed as more real and more alive has never sounded so true as when dealing with the subject of theory. Overall, many of your arguments, as well as a certain amount of irony that is detectable in your account of the historical modes of the debates around theory, seem to be predicated on this thesis. The status of theory concerns a certain missing relation to truth. It seems that almost all positions against theory today are modes in which truth is said to be missing or eluded in the knowledge it produces, hence the charges of it being ahistorical, apolitical, or partial, or Eurocentric, that some aspect of subjective agency or desire is necessary in order to reestablish access to this register of the symbolic. Can you comment on that?
Yes, that's very important. That's crucial, I think. And it's this discourse that I think Camille Paglia and others conveyed in the early 90s, and indeed the very connotations of the word theory are not very promising there. If you are in theory, you are in your ideas and you don't deal with the real world. And a lot of, let's say, this shift that has been observed in literary theory from, let's say, deconstruction and psychoanalytic theories to new historicism was often embraced as a return to history, as if theory had been, in a way, ahistorical. What interested me there, and this is in passing, since I work on modernism, was that the same discourse had been produced about modernism as if modernism had been elitist and ahistorical. And, you know, people like Eliot and Pound were always quoted as if they were elitist and ahistorical. We could return to that. This is a big topic. But in the sense of this politics, the politicization, what struck me when I came to Penn in 92 was the inflation of the term the politics of. At that time, all the students I had were working on the politics of this or the politics of that. And I thought, wow, they are very political here. But I soon realized that the phrase was absolutely empty, and just, you know, they could have the dialectics of, or I have just a sort of little in-joke in the book. I don't know whether you saw it, because at one point I make fun of people who have politics of in their title, and I knew that I had a book on Joyce called Joyce and the Politics of Egoism. So I was just making fun of myself there. And so I have to say that, why did I use that subtitle? Because I had somehow to follow my editor's advice, I have to say. But anyway, and I was talking, I think...
Who said the book won't sell unless you have the politics of in the title?
Still, yeah. The British believe that. Yeah. But I think not so much here. So this idea of politics of, the politics of language, the politics of sexuality, and so on, which was often blamed on the French. Oh, you, and when I would hear, oh, you taught us that everything is political, therefore, you know, everything somehow has to be politicized. I think this has led to this idea, which is, I think, a return to romanticism somehow, that the real is out there, and that fundamentally, as one of my French students said, you know, I cannot write a PhD, life is too short, which may be true in the long run, but as soon as you are engaged in some kind of writing and reading process, I'd say simply, and this is where I am more Lacanian, that there is a real there as well. And this belief in reality, in my own life, I've been through many versions of this reality. When I was a student in 1968, reality was somehow, and many of my friends did this, and it was really noble, I would say, of them, stopping being a student and starting to work in an assembly chain, in a Renault factory, and so on. Some of them emerged, a few didn't, and it was quite an important discovery that, you know, what is the real in this case? Somehow you need at the same time, if not a theory, at least an account of what you are doing, supposing you become a worker with the idea of transforming your factory co-workers into a sort of revolutionary unit. How can you do it? What degree of delusion, utopia, do you have to share in, and so on? Mm-hmm.
Reminds me of the anecdote in the Four Fundamental Concepts, where Lacan talks a very funny passage about working in Sardinia in the summer as a fisherman, and the little story of Petit Jean, who says you see that tin floating out on the ocean, and Lacan says, yes, I see that tin, and he says, well, it doesn't see you, you know, in the sense that. That it's his whole nostalgia and his fantasy of joining the fishermen in the summer, was immediately recognized and thrown back to him.
Yeah. And I think somehow where I come, and there again, it is maybe my autobiographical moment somehow, that it happened that in the early 70s in France, those who tried very hard to be political, who had joined all these leftist groups, ended up on Lacanian couches somehow. And Lacan was the only person who had a discourse that seemed to understand both the subversive intent of the students and who situated himself elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And that somehow posed the question of the master. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also more recently that people like Catherine Liu, whose father was a Maoist, although he was living, Chinese living in the States, could situate this fascination for the master and how to work with that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this is the curious history of theory, which has to do somehow, and this is something I may not have expressed very well in the book because I wrote it very fast and I wanted to get at a few things quickly, a remark made by Foucault, who actually taught me a lot about real politics when he worked with with prisoners that had been freed and so on. And at that time, I was in a group where we would simply listen to what prisoners, people who had been like 10 years in jail, had to say, and I learned a lot. Foucault made that remark about that time, that to him, what was curious was that it was you would have philosophers like Camus and Sartre who had a discourse of ethics, politics, commitment, engagement, and so on. And these happened to be the philosophers who were, or Merleau-Ponty, for that matter, quite an important philosopher to me, but they happened to be the persons who had done the least during the war, whereas Cavaillès and Bloch and so on, who died, had never written about commitment and so on. Like Cavaillès had invented more or less set theory and a number of propositions in mathematical logics. Bloch wrote about history of the Middle Ages. And they never really tried to connect their own field of expertise with a discourse that would somehow justify what they were doing and so on. And in that sense, I mean, that for me was extremely illuminating, and clearly in a Freudian, Lacanian point of view, you can see how much of the, let's say, justification, the justification for what hasn't been done, or excusing somehow a certain sense of ethical guilt was necessary for Sartre and Merleau-Ponty to embrace communism so massively in the 50s and so on.
We've been gradually, this is partly scripted, so we're following a script, but at the same time it's supposedly organic, but it's been developing in a way that I thought our discussion would, and that is that more and more these questions have been inscribed in a psychoanalytic vocabulary, and particularly that of Lacan, knowing you're an expert, in the belief that psychoanalysis in particular may have something important to tell us about the specific problem we have been discussing concerning the subject of theory in the university particularly. And I'm thinking about the status of the university in its famous four discourses, which you alluded to earlier, and how this related to the discourse of hysteria. Since I'm guessing that your reading of the four discourses behind the description of theory is hysterical and hystericizing, I wonder if you could clarify your reading of this.
Right.
And also for the audience as well.
This is a difficult moment in Lacan's thought, but he distinguishes four discourses, one being the discourse of the master, the other discourse of the academic universitaire, then the discourse of the analyst, where he tries to situate himself, and the discourse of hysteria. Hysteria is taken in a very broad sense, which also explains why when I was telling friends, let's say, that my impetus in writing this book was to say theory functions like hysteria, I said, oh, but you're then against theory. I said, no, on the contrary, I am for theory. Oh, how can you somehow see hysteria as positive?
And it's not a petit hysteria.
You're right. But, you know, even the grand hysterique like Camille Paglia can be interesting.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
So what Lacan is saying is that hysteria, and it's a sort of strange structure, is never satisfied with any answer and always asks for more in the name of a certain truth, and therefore knowledge somehow is produced. Mm-hmm. And he connects the scientist and the hysteric as somebody, you know, you can only be a good scientist, according to Lacan, I think it's true up to a point, when you just question absolutely everything and you want to go back to fundamentals and redefine and not be happy with any answer you are given, and so on. Mm-hmm. So this is this element that I see as very productive. And as for the discourse of the university or academia, it's clear that for Lacan, the discourse of, let's say, the Soviet Union of the bureaucracy participates in this somehow. Mm-hmm. So here we have, and he means, for instance, the post-Stalinist moment when somehow apologies have been made for all the dead, and then the system goes on. So I think somehow when today we're talking about building Europe, a new Europe, how can one, you know, be critical of all these good intentions somehow and situate them slightly elsewhere. Is the notion of capitalism or late capitalism or postmodern capitalism that Jameson and others use so useful? Yes and no. I think Lacan tries to negotiate in this moment, which I think is very productive in his thought, with a sort of Freudo-Marxism somehow. But what he introduces, which is rarely introduced in any Marxist discourse, is the dimension of enjoyment or jouissance. Mm-hmm. That is, I think, fundamental to mm-hmm. any discussion of politics today. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think someone like Žižek is indeed, is not the only one, but is indeed somebody who has managed to make sense of all these strands of thinking coming from Althusser, from Lacan, and from the neo-Marxists, Socialisme et Barbarie, Lyotard, and maybe Deleuze with the critique of capitalism from the point of view of schizophrenia, which I think is also a very valid and interesting way of taking all these issues.
Mm-hmm. I think that I recall a wonderful moment from Lacan's seminar on ethics, I believe, in which he describes the characters, and this I think has a particular pertinence for today. At the moment that he was speaking this, it was around the 50s, I believe, as the seminar comes from that period.
Yeah.
And certainly addresses the atomic, the creation of atomic energy and the atomic bomb as being a central problem of jouissance that the world was having at the moment. I mean, will we have it or will we not? And but he made a very canny, as he usually does in a moment of a joke, comment on the structure of the political, which I think that is still true today. He said that typically the conservative intellectual as an individual could be characterized as what he called a knave. And at that moment he uses the English notion of knavery or the knave from, in fact, Shakespeare. But he said that a group of conservative intellectuals are in fact a bunch of fools. And I think that if you can see Bush today, and it's almost a demonstration of this thesis that you get a bunch of conservatives together and they begin looking foolish, whereas you know that behind every one of the group there's a knave at work, Cheney probably. But he said that the problem with the left, or the discourse of the left, is that he said that the leftist critic was often a fool, whereas a group of leftists were often knaves. And so in a certain way there is a, and I was thinking about this in relationship to all you've been talking about, also about the elision of the truth, which I find today more and more under the name of politics, for instance. There will be a jettisoning of a certain notion of validity or legitimation to an argument for a political purpose. And then when there's an overtly ideological purpose that guarantees or in fact validates the moment when one lies.
Right. And I think, I mean, this is crucial today somehow, and I think this is where the academia, taken as a group of maybe knaves, was right to refuse to be too foolish somehow. Yeah. But it looks as if there was this choice: you are either a knave or a fool. In refusing the discourse that was associated with theory as postmodern theory, which is that there is no truth, everything is constructed, therefore everything is easily deconstructed, let's deconstruct Harry and clothes and what else. And so this is where I think a bad version of Derrida played into Rorty's, let's say,
slightly. There's nothing outside the text.
There's nothing outside the text. Yeah, everything is textual. Yeah. We are all there, and you know, fundamentally asserting, and as you can see most clearly in Rorty, very reactionary values of the American right, saying that fundamentally you have the social discourse, that's all construction, meaning all lies, and let's be ourselves, the old individualism coming back, and nature as a sort of source and big mother. I mean, a very reactionary ideology And that indeed, if this is theory, it's good to refuse it. But clearly this is only after a series of total distortions. And I think Derrida, this is why somehow I'm still quite close to Derrida today, even though I am a little worried by the theological turn his thinking has taken. But I think he needed in the American context to go back to issues like God to talk about truth, because he could not otherwise talk about truth, whereas someone like Badiou, who is very Lacanian, had no difficulty inserting in his own discourse things that look very traditional, like, okay, there are truths. Any discourse constructs a truth, and truths are also mathematical truths. You have mathematical truths. They are not constructed. Any discourse is based on a certain logical system, and you can talk about truth like you can analyze mathematical system and so on. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, though, that it's precisely that notion of the distortion, the misrepresentation of particularly deconstruction in theory, which was, I remember, even in the 70s and the 80s, during the period that reader response criticism was coming in. And I think that there was a real political American sense of a kind of theory that was in reader response criticism. But there was a real terror at the same time, because people began responding that, what do critics have to do with it? If all we have to do is record the readings that the students make of every text, I mean, then there's no transformative relation, no position of knowledge or authority in that moment. But also there was the real terror that I think that also moves in with the early reception of theoretical discourses, that the misrepresentation that was hysterical, that it was that there is no truth, that there is no moment of truth. And yet the positions that respond to that are precisely taking that misreading as a representation of theory. But they are acting on that. For the first premise of that, there is no truth, therefore it is strategy.
Right. And I think in that sense, what maybe was seen as the big enemy was Platonism.
Yeah.
And I think this again was something that struck me as being very, very wrong when I came here to teach, to say, oh, but you cannot be a Platonist. Or in the same sense that they would say, oh, Derrida has taught us that presence is bad. You know, oh, really? and clearly, in a number of discussions, Derrida had to tell students, no, presence is the best we can have, but we shouldn't be deluded by what the metaphysics of presence, as filtered by Heidegger, can entail. And in the same way, I say, there was, and maybe Deleuze was perhaps there, a little guilty, a sort of easy anti-Platonism, saying, well, Platonism is idealism, we are all materialists, materialism is good, idealism is bad. Plato somehow launched idealism, and, you know, it's a way of, let's not read Plato. Whereas I think that, and this is also following Lacan, Socrates is the figure of the first hysteric somehow. This is what I mean by the Socratic method, which I really enjoy as a teacher in America, which unhappily, because as you know, this method is simply costly. You need a lot of instructors and not so many students, whereas in the technological setup of the French university, that was my instrument, the microphone, I mean, not the pen, not the discussion, teaching to a big amphitheater of 300 students and so on. And in the Socratic method, you have somehow, if you play the role of Socrates, you have to play the role of the hysteric. Oh, you say that. Why? Do you think that really? You know, you have somehow, and this is really connected with the psychoanalytic method, and there's a good book by Marshall Alcorn about it, really, that shows very concretely how, in a pedagogical situation, you cannot tell people, oh, you believe, say, that individualism is good and that idealism is bad. No, you're wrong. There is, I think, one needs a psychoanalytic perspective to understand that even if you know that students or people or friends can know, but they don't want to know because there is too much enjoyment in their, at times obvious, at times not so obvious, misinterpretation, misconstructions.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to shift the questions now to another tense and talk a little bit about the past. My genealogy begins much later than yours, from the beginning of the 80s and from a different part of the coast. I studied at Berkeley with the likes of Avital Ronell, Jean-Luc Nancy, Philippe Le Coudebart. But I remember quite clearly from the period a dominance of what could be called the first wave of de Mons students, Ronell among them, who could be said to have established the tone of a distinctly American brand of deconstruction. I kind of look back on this period with a mixture of regret, disdain, and admiration. All the political intrigues, backstabbing, the phantom assassinations, it was like watching a Chinese opera. And perhaps we Americans need someone like Elizabeth Brunesco to sort this important historical period out for us. But I think it is the closest we've ever come as a culture to imitating the Parisian social life. What I regret, however, was the somewhat paranoid atmosphere and the heavy-handed, guerrilla-like tactics that were employed by some of this group to establish the place of theory in the departments and in professional organizations. In my view, part of the backlash that has occurred around the continued place of theory was conditioned by the air of intimidation that was employed against members of the profession. You can still see this today when people react with a sense of insecurity in response to, in response to someone who does theory. And it's part of the implicit charge of elitism is that early on, many people use that as a weapon, as a kind of bludgeon to say, well, you're not smart enough to talk to me or something like that. Although this period does play an important role of does not play an important role of the past event in your account, I wonder if you could relate some of your own experience or the perspective on this period, and particularly the early to the mid-late 80s.
Right. Yeah. That's a very important question, because I think any school tends to create mannerisms by which you identify with or against. And I don't know whether you've read this really good and funny book called Wittgenstein's Poker.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see that in Cambridge in the 1930s, everybody, all these British scholars, had started imitating Wittgenstein's habit of being silent and then suddenly having an illumination and then hitting the forehead and saying, ah, yeah, and they were British. I remember a time when you were a French communist, your grammar would deteriorate because Marché, who was the leader, on purpose, I think, or maybe not, would play the proletarian idea of having bad subjunctives and so on. So you had suddenly these people who spoke with a terrible French, whereas the Lacanians had devised a very complex Mallarmian syntax that is I still hear among many of my friends who are Lacanians. They use really particular words in French. They never say to design, they say to point, pointer, and so on, which is very bizarre if you're not part of the group. So I think any group somehow will create these little signs, and indeed, at some point, quoting Hegel, Heidegger, and so on, this display, parading of a certain kind of erudition was the dominant mode by which de Mons and his school somehow asserted authority. But I think all this is, I'd say you're right in calling for a Rudinesco, all this can only be described by a sociology of not only culture, but academic culture and the way, at least this is what I discovered when I came to Penn. I don't want to be too long on that, but somebody who is really a very good scholar and somebody I'm really fond of didn't get tenure, Arkady Plonitsky, to name him, because he was considered a derision. And I remember very well this grievance committee to whom I had to explain who Derrida was. It was really one of my most surrealist moments in the early 90s, mm-hmm. when I had to face a number of scholars. And so it's interesting to meet people who had never heard the name Derrida and just wanted to see whether having a letter by Derrida asserting that the fellow is a good guy was important or not. So mm-hmm. I really to go to absolute basics, talk to people who were simply honest and who understood, and then somehow accepted that he had some reason to grieve. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll respond with an anecdote because of a demonian sort of encounter. I was called up one morning by a graduate student, and they were asking me what I was doing, and I said, well, I just spent the morning reading Henry James' Figure in the Carpet, and I'm writing on it right now. And I worked pretty quickly. So and the response was, really? And it took me 2 years to read that text. So there was this moment of the demonians, that would take years and years for them to, because the notion of reading was, of course, overdetermined in the sense that no one could actually really read something in the morning, and I was a fool for thinking I was going to do that. Now, Rennell's group, there is a very interesting social relationship there was an imitation, the creation of imitation, and in Rennell's group it was everybody started wearing dog collars and things like that. I also remember that period. Yeah, go ahead. But
maybe I think...
Nobody wore dog collars in your class?
No, but I've seen, you know, like the goth look appear.
That was at the same time.
Mostly, in students and so on, and some colleagues, yeah. I haven't seen here, but I've seen in France colleagues who would have like dyed hair, very white, and so on. But I think maybe since you talked about Paul de Man, a lot of what has to do with the bad reputation of theory has to do with this endless trial of de Man, and it would be a complex issue to discuss right now. I'd say simply, for me, I'm not a de Manian, although I like some of his texts, I don't like certain he's written. There is indeed something that is on purpose, I would say, obfuscating or difficult in his writing, so that it's not so easily comprehensible. But I'd say that for me, fundamentally, it's not because somebody has been a collaborator, a collaborationist as a young man, that if you suddenly discover this, his writing should be burnt. And this is my attitude facing Heidegger, Céline, Pound, and so on. So I think there we could discuss it. It's a difficult position, but mm-hmm. I'd say that for me, when I learned that de Man had been this extreme right supporter in the 20s, he became more interesting, not less interesting. Thought, there is something to de Man after all, and so on. So, I mean, this is... I would say that the American reaction, and have many discussions with many friends who were suddenly devastated, and they were... I mean, I could hardly tell them that. I say, no, but it's like Céline. No, Céline is very interesting. He was a fascist. Let's understand that. No. Why not make sense of it? It's important. A lot in the 20th century had to do with fascism. Mm-hmm. Let's understand that.
And the belief that no intellectual could fall for
exactly.
fascism.
Yeah.
Well, there's also, I mean, it was part of this earlier period that we're tracing historically, too. It was the rise of a very experimental and a very early kind of theory, and I'm thinking of the books like Avital Rennell's Telephone Book, and of a very experimental style that emerged. It's partly in response to Derrida's period of Glas and the period that Tel Quel was a dominant influence in France and Paris. But this was the height of the Reagan era, and I remember it's a very odd and interesting kind of truism to say that a more conservative political environment produces a more hysterical left environment, in the sense one of the things that I was part of in the early 80s was a group called Radio Free Theory. And this was in Berkeley, where we actually put a radio show together that starred several people like Ronell and Peter Canning and others. And we had schizophrenic weather reports and a television or a radio version of Freud's The Rap Man. And it actually aired on the PBS radio station. But this was, it seemed like anything was possible in this environment. And the more kind of radical that we became, the more possible it seemed. And I think that we went way over the bounds of good taste in the process. But I wonder if you think about that. And then the period that followed, I think precisely around the emergence of the revelation by Farias and others of the existence of the wartime writings, of the Flemish writings of de Man, that there is a closing down of some of the more surrealist, experimental aspects of this discourse.
I mean, you could say Lacan himself, with his very bizarre syntax and florid style, was one of the first to perform theory somehow. I think it's a good suggestion for Aaron, and I think we, you know, tomorrow we should start the Ratman's talks here at Slot. This is a program, and why not? We'll see. But this moment of experimentation seems to have passed.
Yeah.
Except maybe Navitar's work somehow.
But it's already there, registers a trace of something that is not co-determinants or present. You know?
And I'd say my reaction here is to take a slightly broader perspective and precisely go back to major texts like Coleridge, Biographica, Literaria, or Sartre, Resartus, Carlyle's book, you know, these texts that to me are theory somehow, and that were 19th century, or you could go back Kierkegaard and a number of texts. This mixture of theory, writing, experimentation, blurring the boundaries, this was Derrida's, I think, most systematic gesture in the 80s, and I like Glas, for instance. I think it's a good book, and I'm surprised when I see people, maybe because I'm attuned, maybe because I started reading English with Finnegan's Wake somehow, this seems tame in comparison with Finnegan's Wake. And this is the gesture of the avant-garde. This is the gesture of transition in the 30s and so on, that presupposes that by subverting language, you can subvert politics, thought, and so on. I think we have gone back to a more conservative attitude and the excess, the very excess of this gesture and its repetitive nature, I think, somehow condemned it. But I think that it's, why not? Why exclude that? But interestingly, it's something that de Man, for instance, never did. And maybe there is something to be said at a time when the de Manian discourse was getting a little stereotyped. It's interesting to see that Derrida and the American deconstructionists or people like Avital Ronell work on, you know, changing types and settings and opening the page and so on, which means that somehow theory is not opposed to poetry, and that a lot of language poetry I see as theory. It's exactly what I heard many of my friends in France who are poets would come to California and exchange with Californian poets in the 80s or 90s, and I said, this is terrible. We want to talk about Ginsberg. They only want to hear what Derrida has been writing recently. So indeed, there was a time when the American avant-garde was absolutely fascinated by theory, whereas the poets in France had too much of theory and were going to a more direct sense of poetry experimentation.
Well, this is a good, I'm going to now just ask one final question, which is basically to rephrase or to repeat to you in a very Lacanian gesture the title of your book as a question. So what is the future of theory And you spoke about this in terms of the possibility of an avant-garde, about the very forms of experimentation that question the level by which we read the text, and that has to continue in some way. But have you, you must have thought about this. You titled your book, I think not unironically, but, but in the current moment. But what is the future?
Yeah, no, I, at one point I said, well, as you know, Rabelais, you have the prophecies of Rabelais, and it says, well, tomorrow the blind will not see, the deaf will not hear. And I say, this is the future of theory. But apart from this joke, I think theory should reemerge simply because one needs this meta-discursive level in order to know what one does as an artist, as a scholar, as a writer, and it's not so new somehow. And I think my point of view is somehow to go back in time and to see exchanges, parallels with, let's say, the age of Dante, the age of Bruno, these texts that have poems and then theories about the world and so on. I think somehow maybe because of the politicization of the academic struggles and the theory wars, one forgets that there's a longer history to theory. And if, of course, if one agrees, for instance, I have quoted this book and it's an important book, but one, you know, Balzac, I use in the book Balzac's funny take on Théorie de la démarche. It's hard to translate into English, but it's a parody of theory as such, just talking about walking, how people walk, and so on. Or if one takes Sartor Resartus as a book that falls under the heading of theory, and, you know, I like one of these days to teach a class on theory with only these books. No Derrida, no Marx, no Lacan, just Carlyle, Balzac, and Bruno, Ficino, and a few others. Mm-hmm. And you can do theory with that. If you accept that this is feasible and that it does not imply a historical perspective, but on the contrary, an awareness that there is a complex history, theory is today or now. Mm-hmm. That would be my answer.
Well, thank you. Why don't we use this time remaining to just open up questions from the floor? Would that be okay?
Given that the audience is bifurcated, and we can't all hear the other team
speaking,
and then being recorded, could you guys just repeat whatever?
Certainly.
Yeah. Certainly. We repeat your questions.
Considering that the relationship between language and theory is an integer, and I'm just wondering if a paradigm shift in theory, how would it affect it in the long run? And considering that this is a very pragmatic society that puts a lot of emphasis on literature, how would you reconcile very profound shifts in theory?
I think that, I mean, from one way to respond right away is to see precisely the, well, the question was the shift in theory, how is it related to the shift in method or methodology, say, in different disciplines or fields? I think already there's a signature of a kind of emergence of what is theory in the United States particularly, that is completely concentrated on method. For instance, what does it mean to read? What does it mean to see or to look, for instance, at a film? These are the areas where we've seen the emergence of theory, particularly in the disciplines. And I think that the emergence of de Man, for instance, as a figure in the late 70s and the 80s, occurred around a flurry of questions around method and methodology pertaining to the reading of literature. But I would also say, very importantly, to the emergence of feminist literary criticism and critics like Judith Federle, who articulated that the very space of reading needed to be clarified methodologically because it was programmatic, it was gendered, it was in a certain sense already part of implied already a theoretical question of is method neutral or is it simply a program of sorts that we produce?
But I think it's a good question because there's been, maybe there are several paradigm shifts, but at least insofar as part of the book contains a history of the Telkel movement mm-hmm. and the history of the introduction of structuralism into the United States, namely the 60s, I remember very well how in Europe, I'd say it's not only in France, in Europe, linguistics at that time was seen as the dominant science. And when I was a student, we would all start, each class would begin, whatever the topic was, with a little bit of Saussure, and then when people were a little advanced, some Chomsky, and so on. And there was the belief that you had some hard sciences like that, linguistics. And I think we've lost that belief today, mm-hmm. and it's not been replaced by any other science. I don't think we, as literary scholars, philosophers, even if we say philosophy, we know that philosophy is a very complex field of discourses in the plural, and mm-hmm. you cannot say, okay, philosophy is, let's say, Hegel, or Wittgenstein, or Marx, or Plato, and so on. So what I'd say is that this is why you were right to talk about gender. Why is it suddenly that gender became such an important topic? Because it sends us back to the constitution of a discourse, that is namely to the subject and the effects of power and the effect of structuration of a field in the name of, let's say, who decides what is what, mm-hmm. or who decides what is an author, mm-hmm. or what is an author, or to follow Foucault, precisely what Foucault calls the inventors of discursivity, like Marx and Freud, are not to be understood like scientists by a sort of, is their theory right or wrong? Refutation, not refutation. But as Foucault defines the inventor of discursivity, they force to an endless rereading. So you have, because the field of culture has absorbed them, Marx and Freud are in our culture, but we cannot refute them like that. We can say we use them, we don't use them, and therefore we are constantly rereading them and they become part of the discourse. So I think it's a little where we are now, more attentive to these effects that are obviously sexual, political, social, and so on. Mm-hmm. That have to do with the constitution of a new subject that emerges.
During my lifetime, I've seen hypotheses being inflated into theories, and nobody speaks of hypotheses, which really, now that I know about the future of theory, there is one question I have. What is
it? What is a theory? By the book. Other question?
This is it.
The way that distress was registered was theory erases history, theory is a disruption in history, theory is an eradication, because we have history, we have literary history, we have, you know, whatever, you know, cultural history and so on, economic history, but theory is an eraser of that. But it actually seemed to me that, and then of course you realize this, that what that was really all about was a denial and a recognition of the fact that what theory was offering was us and a profound history that would indeed substitute for the kinds of, if you like, often muddled histories that were offered to especially literature writers. In it, and anyone who taught theory knows it doesn't work unless you teach it historically, and it really doesn't operate. And that's in your own writing is a wonderful way of taking us always back through a marvelous temporal trajectory. So in a certain way, the question that I have is, to what extent do you think the American Academy has been successful finally assimilating theory to its own working by constructing it as a history? That is, we now have a plethora of textbooks that operate in terms of the kind of emergence of concepts up to the Enlightenment, down to the Enlightenment, and so on. I mean, to what extent do you think that the construction of a discipline of literary theory in the United States has had to do with the successful or perhaps not successful construction of a history to this representational and teachable?
That's a great question, and yeah. we could talk a lot about. I mean, I'd say that we now become, as you said, more aware of the history of theory. But I was struck rereading the Baltimore debate, for instance, when de Man and Barthes discussed already then, Roland Barthes arrives to Baltimore with, you know, the prestige of French structuralism, and is attacked extremely violently by Paul de Man, who we tend now to see as ahistorical, who tells him, oh, this is terrible, this is bad, you don't know literary history, your concept of modernity is wrong, read the Romantics, and so on. So already in 66, you had the terms of the debate somehow. And I think somehow this today, as I would see through maybe Badiou, historicism is also dangerous. There is a way of doing historicism that I think as a bad symptom produces this idea, okay, this is over, what's next? We're done with this, what's the next school? Let's not waste our time reading all these difficult books. Tell us, you know, who will be the two or three emerging theories I need to know 6 years down the line when my PhD will be over.
Just the facts.
And I'll be on the market.
The facts.
Yeah.
A kind of new positive. Right. I wanted to respond also, I think, to both questions. Jameson is very useful, and there's also in relationship to Lyotard is that, and I'll historicize this a bit because I think that's part of what our conversation was about tonight too. In the early 80s, there was an incredible insecurity by the humanities and anybody in the humanities that was caused by the changing structure of funding in the universities in the United States and the incredible imbalance of the hard sciences. So part of one of the motives historically for the emergence of theory was the fact that the hard sciences were getting all of the money and the humanities were fearing for their lives on a yearly annual basis. This is something that is constantly part of the trauma scenario that we're experiencing today as well. Now with a new bogey, which is the high finance and capitalism that has moved into the university. But so the part of the attraction of linguistics, of Saussure, of structuralism, was to shore up what was seen by many others as a purely subjectivist form of evaluation. There was no truth because it was just simply subjective. Jameson said, though, that there is one fundamental problem that we have, that is the basis of our knowledge is made in narratives. We talk about history, we're always talking in a narrative about a narrative. And he said that the only manner that we have is non-scientific. We can't go to empirical evidence. But theory is really the mode of legitimation by which narratives become truth, right? So in a sense, what is the most realizable narrative or the most dominant narrative of history is in fact the object of theory. I think that today much of the debates are concerning of theory itself and of what is coming after it. History, again, is about, in a sense, a new narrative of the real or of history. Yeah. Yes, go ahead, sir.
I have a future-oriented question. It begins with a remarkable phrase about Roman paintings. It's concerned that folks have got more and more conservative, so it's about a certain kind of playfulness and certain hysterical playfulness. But clearly, it's maybe that kind of moment again. But as I compare what's possible in, say, England, which I know particularly well, something, the dimensions of the term of Christ, right, what goes on year by year, there's also a public discourse of hysteria around the term of Christ. It's clearly a national event, a national happening. Yeah, I don't see that kind of possibility in the United States right now because of the control of the media, which just walls out any kind of commentary like that. In England, all your friends are part of the public sphere. They're on television, they're on the radio. In the United States, they're walling out. You get the Hollywood Minute, and that's about it. And the only kind of hysteria you get is an important one where you get Christopher Lee's painting with animal bone featured, which in the mayor of New York takes an objection to. So, do you see that public conditions in the United States really kind of wall out that kind of
Well, I can make a joke. I hope you don't mind. I think that whereas hysteria is where we locate our hysteria in the university, the British locate their hysteria in the media. And having been in London last spring, I remember long, long bouts of Willie doing marijuana and all of the consternation about the response of Prince Charles. But I think it is a very different, but I think that there is a relationship to the media in British media that is completely different in the United States, whereas in the academy it's also very different. So so ask your question again, though, because I was thinking. Go ahead.
But maybe to it's a little detail I used at the beginning of the book. I was interested in the way Empire, this book, was somehow sold as the new thing in the New York Times, for instance. And I think, of course, in the States, it's very bizarre somehow how, I don't want to sound too snobbish, but having been to Mexico City a few times, you know, you watch the news and every morning you have half an hour on books and poetry readings and so on the normal channel, you know. This is not something you have here, and maybe it will change, who knows, but I'm not so optimistic. Yes. So I think the relays in the States are more magazines, the place, the sites of intellectual knowledge and power that are reputed, and this is how things happen. I mean, the difference with France, and I think somehow things happened so well and so fast in France in the 60s because all this took place within, you know, something that is not much bigger than West Philly. Mm-hmm. That is two or three areas of Paris where you have, let's say, 40 places that basically you could, if you go there, you meet everybody and so on. And the seminars were all located in there. So it's very, very difficult to compare with the difficulties of disseminating knowledge and concentrating and so on. But you see, once in a while, the need for this hype somehow, the new things, the future. This is why my title wanted to be a little ironical facing this. And, you know, it's not that I felt a little obliged at the end to, in a question that was the most sarcastic question that you didn't read. You said that I had a grocery list of tasks and so on. But I try nevertheless to anticipate and to see what will be done in the next 20 years. But of course, this remains within the field of academia.
Yeah.
Which is already big, you know, the dissemination of books, publication, academic presses, and a number of learned journals. This is enough, somehow, sociologically speaking, to create a cultural revolution. If you think, for instance, that most of the avant-garde movements that took place in Europe at the end of the 19th century would touch 200 people or so, maybe 500. But, you know, in terms of numbers, if you think of symbolism and the circulation of the magazine there, or even modernism, high modernism, the number of people who subscribe to the New Free Women, 100.
And I think that this is a prevalent danger right now in this culture, is the incredible homogeneity that is produced by this media and the dominance of the media, corporate medias. But the tendency, and I think as I talked about the 80s as being an incredible insecurity among humanists and the response to the sciences, I think today the dominance of celebrity, of media, of that on all of our lives has reproduced itself again as a symptom of insecurity in the academic personality to want to become the celebrity, to want to find what the new thing is. But the incredible monotonous nature that we do this, we don't do it well in the academy. And so, but people begin to look to find the next thing or the next wave, even in terms of who they're going to hire for a job in the next year. And do so in incredible There is some form of publicity in the Habermasian sense, because there's an incredible monotony that overrules the disciplines in the sense of everybody agreeing. There's a consensus that is arrived at almost hysterically, and everybody agreeing at the same time, this is it. But the question itself is a hysterical question. What is it that you want? You know, I mean, we're driven by that, even to the point where we're constantly trying to demonstrate to someone, some other, who ends up being ourselves, that we're worth something. And so in the academy, I think we have to be very careful about the effects of that on an intellectual culture, and of even stifling the possibility of intellectual culture.
Please stay now. There's a lot of wine.
Thank you.
Thank you.